My guest today is Jim Hollingsworth, author of the excellent 2021 book, Climate Change, A Convenient Truth.
I got interested in weather way back in about 1960 when I was going to college and I ran the weather station for a year. And I got really interested in climate patterns and so forth. And then later, when I studied geology and then I worked in a mine for 9 years, I began to realize that most of what you hear in the press is just a lot of hooey about what's going on with the climate, because the climate has come and gone and it changed for, well, hundreds of years.
Okay. And what was the process from that led you to write your book? I'd like to talk about your book.
I've probably read 100 articles and a couple dozen books on climate, and they all have one thing in common. They have a lot of charts and graphs and a lot of real technical information. Well, most people can't understand that. So I decided to write something down on my level, which was basically I wrote it for high school kids and adults that are not taught, they can read it and understand it. So this book includes 48, they're really short chapters and designed just to hit the high points and to demonstrate that most of what's in the press is not true. You know, you see what come out of COP28 that they just held. Some of our leaders and world leaders are all pretty much the same idea, that we got to eliminate fossil fuel and we got to get everything so that it just runs on wind and solar. But right now, wind and solar is only a couple percent. And, you know, these things are an eyesore now. Can you imagine what the country will look like when they have enough to do 100%? But not only that, right where I am, I guess I could turn the camera out there, but it's been cloudy. It's been cloudy, say, 90% of the time for the last 3 months. You could no way build a battery big enough to take you through those cloudy days. And so I got started with this, and then Dr. Will Happer recommended me to join the CO2 Coalition, which has been, it's just turned out to be a marvelous organization. I know you just interviewed Greg Wrightstone, and he and Will Happer were in Wyoming. I never did get a report on how that turned out, but there's a lot going on some of those places. We need something for the average person. There's so much hype out there, and it's all designed to make people terrified. The world's going to end, it's going to burn up, and the little girl comes home from school, she's crying, and her mother says, "What's wrong?" She said, "Well, my teacher said the world's going to end, and I don't know what I'm going to do about it." Well, you know, the sun comes up. Hey, here's the thing. They're talking about an increase of 1.5 degrees centigrade. Where we are here, it gets to maybe 102, and it could get down to 35 below. So a degree and a half wouldn't even be noticeable. I mean, you could say, well, maybe that's a little warmer, but it's just designed to build fear. It's not designed to solve any problems.
So there are 40-plus chapters in your book. It's just great stuff. And are you okay with just covering some certain items in there, like forest fires? Yeah.
Go ahead.
Do you want to talk about fires and what may have caused forest fires to increase after that 1982 or 83 low point?
Forest fires are caused by a number of things. So lightning, human-caused fires, accidents, all kinds of things. But in the main, the serious forest fires are caused because you rarely see a forest fire on private land, and almost never see one on state land because they maintain their forests. They cut out the brush. And forest fires increased a lot when we outlawed cattle. You know, when I used to hike in the Sierras a lot, we'd come onto cattle all the time. Well, they quit doing that. Well, the cattle kept all the brush down. And so this brush catches fire, and it just sets a tree on fire, and then pretty soon you got a crown fire. And they're tough. Where I grew up in Southern California, the mountains, the San Gabriel Mountains, had fire paths along the tops of each ridge. And every summer you'd see a fire. It's just, it was a normal thing. And then they get wind sometimes 70, 80, 90 miles an hour, enough to blow a truck just blow it over, topple it completely. And when you got a fire with that kind of wind, you can imagine what it does. But anyway, I just decided that I needed to write something that people could understand if they wanted to. You know, there's several different kinds. There's people that know the truth that are working against it, so you can't do much for them. And there's some that are just plain stupid and don't care to know anything else. But there still are a few people in the world that really want to know the truth that you can talk to. It's like my doctor. I was at my heart doctor last week, and I said, you know, I know you're a Democrat because you don't want to talk to me. He wouldn't visit about anything. And he said to me, you're very perceptive. Well, that's the point. I've had acquaintances over the years that were Democrats, but I could never get them in a conversation about anything. It's just they don't want to have to face the truth. I think that's the matter.
So one thing I do like about your book is that you dig in so far on, I learned a ton just about this issue of wildfires. You're talking about ladder fuels, and you're talking about, yeah, I did not even know the difference between the fires on privately owned land versus federal land. Huge difference in recent decades, correct?
Well, plus, fires will start on federal land, and you know, there's no sign that says stop fire here, and it comes over onto private land. But, you know, a lot of times you'll see it in a movie. There'll be a forest of trees, and then here will be another scene. And all everything, the ground's barren, the trees, the branches up about 8 feet are all gone off the trees. That's where they have really prevented fires. And they never have fires in those situations. And where I did a lot of camp work in the Sierras, we had a lot of lightning strike fires. They would just hit a tree and it'd catch fire. We'd go out there with a shovel and put the fire out. Well, those were small trees and separated by quite a while. You could do that. But when you get into the bigger forests, the fire takes off. Like in Alaska, where my kids are, if a forest catches fire, a lot of times they just let it burn till winter when the snow comes and puts it out. But a fire is just part of nature. You know, God designed fires, and because the fire helps fertilize the ground and so on and so forth, and the Indians knew how to deal with fire. They never had a huge problem either.
Yeah, they did a lot of burning themselves, didn't they, some of the tribes out west?
Sometimes they did.
Okay. Yeah, getting back to what you said earlier, I'm going to read one quote from your book that I think is a very good one. Quote, "For the alarmists are so sure that they are right, and they are so busy trying to save the world, they just do not have time to discuss anything." Great quote there.
Isn't that the truth?
It is.
They not only don't have the time, they won't take the time. I mean, if you want to talk about something, you can always find time, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Another observation you made here is, quote, "The petroleum age saved whales from the brink of extinction." You want to talk about that?
Well, have you ever heard of coal oil?
I think I have, yeah.
When I was a kid growing up, we called kerosene coal oil. And I never gave it any thought till the other day I was doing a little research on the subject. The first kerosene was made from coal. And actually, you could get just about everything that we have in oil from coal by heating it. It'll drive it off and you get a liquid. But the kerosene, up until that point, lamps were mostly lit with whale oil. Well, where do you get whale oil? Well, you get it from dead whales. So when they invented or discovered kerosene, which was one of the first products that they produced after they discovered oil, it saved the whales because kerosene was a lot better product than whale oil. And it's, of course, even today where you live in cultures that don't have electricity, they still don't use kerosene. They use like what would be maybe a dark diesel oil because it blackens up the chimney in a hurry. There was, where we were in Mexico, there was an Israeli-built aircraft that came in and landed, and for some reason he couldn't get stopped, and the pilot turned the plane into a ditch and broke off the front landing gear. Well, here's this plane with damaged, and it's full of fuel, so they took off all the fuel because they thought they had some bad fuels where the plane had trouble, and they gave it to the Danes. And they were pretty excited about it because it was far better than the lamp oil they were using. But of course, it took 6 months to repair the plane. They had a contingent of soldiers that slept under the plane. But anyway, kerosene really was a savior. And then it's, you know, it was years later, even the guy Diesel that had invented the diesel engines that were, well, you see what's going on today, but he eventually died and he found his body floating in the ocean. It's kind of an interesting story of Rudolf Diesel. But gasoline engines, Henry Ford probably was the one that made the most use of internal combustion engines, gasoline engines. And about 1912, they had some. In fact, I think I have a chapter on that, electric cars. But the top speed was about 12 miles an hour. I never could figure that one out. But they were luxury cars with leather seat covers and all kinds of stuff. The electric cars didn't go anywhere then. And of course, even in those days, there were very few homes that had electricity. So if your battery went dead, you were just dead. But when internal combustion engines came along, like the Model T, Ford, and so forth, they were able to build thousands of them, and people bought them because they were cheap and provided transportation. They were far better than electric car. I mean, today, look at the electric cars today. They're not very practical. Number one, they're very expensive. Not everybody's going to own one. Number two, when they get to the point where an ordinary car would be at resale, I mean, you could get a second-hand car, by that time the batteries are worn out, and replacing a battery is just about half the cost of the vehicle. So usually when the battery wears out, the car just thrown away. And electric cars are a hazard on the highway because they weigh about 1,000 pounds more than a regular car because of the weight of the battery. So there's dividers that separate, you know, traffic going both ways, but they've gone right through some. They're so heavy. So, you know, you can see the problem they would be. But another problem that electric cars had was, well, not had, but have, is this was in Florida, especially, where they were parked along the ocean. And when a big tidal wave would come and the car would be just swamped with seawater, that seawater would get on top of the battery and the car would catch fire. And they had a lot of problems with people parking cars in their garage and the house burned down. So they had to learn after they'd been wet to park them in the driveway. But electric cars, you know, they would be practical to run from office, from home to office and back home again. But nobody that's in a hurry is going to buy an electric car and try to drive across the country when about every 2-3 hours they got to stop for an hour or two and charge the battery. Even Granholm, you know, the secretary, she started out and she didn't get very far. And then she went to a charging station and it was all filled up with people. She'd had one of her people try to hold a spot for her. That didn't work. So when she finally got there, she was in a hurry. So she went and rented a regular car and went on her way.
So she had a hydrocarbon-fueled support team, too, right? People driving ahead, and it wasn't like she was by herself in her car.
Right. Yeah. She was driving an electric car, but she had this team that would go up ahead and try to find a spot. And then they got in all kinds of trouble because they were saving a spot that somebody was there that couldn't charge their car. So it was a terrible situation.
I have a couple other quotes about the history of electric cars that I wanted to read here from your book. So the first electric car in the U.S. was developed in 1890 to 91 in Des Moines. It was a 6-passenger wagon capable of reaching 23 kilometers an hour or 14 miles per hour. Then, by the turn of that century, 22% of cars were driven by gasoline, 40% by steam, and 38% of cars back then were electric. And then I think around 1912 was the peak of the electric car. And then gas-powered cars took over after that, right?
That sounds right.
Oh, just from the next chapter, here's another discussion point. Scientists have discovered that with warmer weather, plants move farther north and higher up in the mountains, but they don't abandon their original habitat. There's this idea that the pikas are going to just keep moving up the mountain until they hit the tip of the mountain, and then they can't go any further. But they're not abandoning their territory further down, correct?
Well, here's the thing. Storms of my grandchildren. The guy that wrote this book, he really believes strongly in climate change. And he said this, that species would become extinct because they would come to where there was a city and there wouldn't be any place that they could put down roots, so they would all die and they couldn't go any farther. And I immediately read that and I said, this guy never planted a garden, did he? Did you ever plant a garden? I mean, sure. You go out there and I didn't plant all those weeds. Where did they come from? Well, you know, the wind blows in the seeds. And his article was just full of stuff like that. He was terrified that his grandkids would live in a world that burned up, and he was doing all he can. And they had a big rally in Washington, D.C. Oh, it's been about 6-7 years ago, but they were going to really complain about global warming. And so they had this rally, and they had to cancel it because there was 2 feet of snow on the ground.
Next chapter, or another chapter of your book, a good quote here. In medieval times, the high priests threatened people that they would burn in hell if they didn't leave money at the altar. Today, the threat is hell on earth if we don't pay carbon taxes in order to keep government bureaucrats employed. Any comment on that?
Well, if you look, say, take COP28 that was held in Davos, last year was an interesting conference because the guy that read it was from an Arab country whose main product is oil. So they're trying to outlaw all fossil fuels. So he's up there chairing the program, kind of tongue-in-cheek, because if you eliminate fossil fuels, he and all of his compatriots would go hungry, and they all know that. So anyway, all these intellectuals, all these politicians from all over the world, I think 170 countries, yeah, they all fly in with their expensive jets and park. I don't know where in the world they park that many jets, but they park them. Anyway, they're producing more carbon dioxide than anybody else. But here's the point. They want us to live without fossil fuels, but they're sure not willing to do it. And they have one attitude. And their attitude is, you got to do these certain things. But the average person, if you were to go outside on the street in your town and just ask, do you think global warming is going to destroy our town? What do you think the average person would say?
No.
They would say no. And so who's pushing this? It's the politicians. Now, they want money. And what are they going to do with the money? They're going to give it to the poorer countries, like Africa. They're trying to get Africa to do without fossil fuels. Here's Africa, the poorest continent in the world. What these people need right now is electricity, and they need gasoline. And so you say, okay, now you can't have those. And they come back and say, well, look, you had that when you developed. Why are we put down? But this is the thing. They are actually relegating Africa to poverty, because if you don't have, you know, I don't think a lot of people have thought about it, but America is great because of oil was discovered and coal and even nuclear, but we have grown it. And in fact, I don't think I mentioned it in the book because it's something that happened since. I'd be glad to send somebody my article, but someone wrote and said there were over 6,000 things made from fossil fuels. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So I went online and I saw all these things, you know, they had would say over 6,000 things made from fossil fuels. And I'd click on it and there'd be about 100. And then I'd click on the next one and there'd be about 100. So I collected all these, a lot of them were different lists. And then I started going around the house and going, oh, yeah, that's made from fossil fuel. That's made from fossil fuel. So I came up with 1,700, but at least you could see where it was headed. The main things were no highways, because you wouldn't have any oil for pavement. No vinyl siding, no vinyl fencing. Walk in a supermarket. Every item in that supermarket is some kind of a plastic container. And plastic comes from oil. A lot of people don't know that. Plastic is a major thing that comes from oil. And so you eliminate, now You know, it's just like, take a ship, for example. Ships, most ships today probably run on diesel. But, you know, they could run on solar, wind. But why don't they? It's because sail ships were very slow, and when they invented motors for them, the sails very rarely got used. And that's the thing. If no one's come up with a means of using solar for aircraft, they're still, well, they've designed some aircraft that run on solar, but then, I mean, they can only carry like 100 pounds.
Yeah, I think I've seen elsewhere that for a battery to contain as much energy as the average fuel load of a jetliner, that battery would have to weigh over 3 million pounds. Then the plane could, of course, never take off.
Well, you see stories about cities with a battery backup, you know, for their electricity. Well, even a huge battery will only provide electricity for a couple hours. And like I just said, here in Idaho, we've had 3 months practically total. In fact, from my perspective, and I don't have any statistics to back it up, but this is just how I feel about it, that solar panels probably make very little sense north of the 45th parallel, because the light comes in at such an angle you don't get. Well, then, north of the 45th parallel, we have a lot of snow. What does snow do to a solar panel?
Yeah, it covers it. Here in Minnesota, I see solar farms or facilities just covered with snow, and nobody's cleaning it off. They're just waiting for spring, I think.
So if you don't go out and shovel it off, you might get maybe 1% through the snow, which I don't know. I don't have any statistics for that. But the obvious thing is solar panels make no sense for Canada and Alaska and northern, like, you know, the northern states. But they continue to push them because there's the big deal. And in fact, even here in Idaho, I was talking to the representative for our local utility, and he said we had to do something. And I said, why in the world is that? He said, well, it's because we also sell electricity in Washington, and Washington State is now requiring this to be done. So, you know, some of these states like California and Washington and Oregon have just really jumped on the bandwagon. And they're going to be living in cold, dark houses if they get their way, because that's the way it'll go.
I'm looking it up here, but somewhere in your book, you talk about some town, maybe in Texas, that grandly said they were going to run on wind and solar power, but they never thought about what they're going to do if the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining. You remember that one?
Well, not only that, but that's about 2 years ago. So this story that you're talking about is earlier than that. And but anyway, you know, they had people die because the grid froze up. They didn't have enough electricity and they couldn't heat their houses. You know, today they're talking about eliminating gas stoves and gas furnaces. But, you know, if you try to heat with electricity, the grid out there, the electrical grid that provides all our electricity, wouldn't be able to provide enough to meet all of our need. I mean, in Texas, what they did was they had Al Gore was really excited about the project because they were going to go 100%, and they got their electricity from solar panels some miles away and so forth. But the problem still was that they didn't know. They never answered the question of what they would do when the sun wasn't shining and the wind doesn't blow. And I don't know if where you grew up, if you've noticed it, but when it gets down close to zero, the wind rarely blows. It's really quiet. And right here in Idaho, now it's 24 today, the wind's blowing a little. But when it gets down around 10 or so degrees, the wind doesn't blow. Well, that's when you need the wind the most. I mean, you need electricity. And wind turbines, you see pictures of them all the time with the blades broken. These are mammoth things. They're a couple hundred feet tall. And it costs thousands of dollars to build one. They have to pour huge things of concrete for a base to hold them. Otherwise, they just blow over. And they break. Sometimes they catch on fire. In fact, men have been up there on top working on them, trying to solve a problem, and things happen, and they just die up there. And they're very hard on. I'm not quite sure why this is, But raptors, like hawks and eagles, do not see a turning blade for some reason, or are killed. Bats also are killed in large numbers. And then there was low-frequency sound. Some people are really susceptible to it, and they don't want, not in my backyard. You've heard that story. But anyway, they found that they were affected, the whales. So there was a project that was supposed to start in this time frame, and they canceled it because they finally decided they were not going to be good for the whales. But wind out in the ocean, you know, you'd get more wind out there. But especially, you know, oceans that are close to land, you get what's called daily changes in direction. So in the daytime, the land warms up warmer than the ocean, so the air rises where the land is. The wind then comes in from the ocean to the land and rises up. Then as it cools up, the land gets cold and the ocean's warmer than the land. So the ocean, the air rises over the ocean and the wind goes the other way. So you get this wind going back and forth. And you know, theoretically, at least, that's a good thing. But still, nothing beats fossil fuel. No matter what you do in natural gas, we've got so much natural gas, they flare it. That's a term meaning that they just burn it off. And even here where we live, we have a spot that's so it's about 5 miles from where we live. But used to be a county dump there, and they filled it up, and they covered it over with plastic and dirt, and now there's a park there. But they have pipes that run over to where we recycle our stuff, and there's methane, natural gas, that comes from that dump all the time, just keeps producing methane. Because, you know, you take a log, a tree, okay, if that tree burns in the forest, it gives off carbon dioxide. But if that tree stays there, it stays there and stays there, and then it falls over and it totally rots away, it gives off the same amount of carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide is a very normal thing. And a lot of people don't think about this, but carbon dioxide comes in for a lot of criticism. But, you know, we wouldn't even be here if it weren't for carbon dioxide, because every plant you see, those that are in your picture, but every plant you see requires carbon dioxide. Now, right now, there's 420, actually, parts per million carbon dioxide. That's not, I mean, that's just a trace. Can you imagine that from that trace, every plant, every bush, every tree, all the vegetables we eat all come from that little bit. And one thing they've noticed, NASA's noticed, because NASA takes pictures all the time, but they've noticed that the Sahara is, there's places where the green is moving in on the desert because there's more carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide, we should be going, "Ray, more carbon dioxide," because gardens do better. And right here in Idaho this year, it's been an open winter. We haven't had more than 6 inches of snow on the ground at one time. Now I'm thinking, you know, maybe I should plant my garden in May. Usually nothing does well here until about the 1st of July. You can plant corn in the ground, the seeds will just rot. You can sprout them, and it'll come up and get about that high, and it won't do much until about, well, the middle of June anyway. But weather's important.
So I do have a few wind turbine-related facts and figures here to catch up with. That town we were talking about is Georgetown, Texas, that was going to go all renewable. I don't know. That's I haven't heard any updates from there, but I bet they didn't do it. There's that. And then the end of the wind turbine blade, the Google says that can be going 175 miles an hour. So maybe that's why it's hard for a raptor to get out of the way if it's coming at them 175 miles an hour.
I don't think they see it. I think that's the problem.
Okay. And then another thing is that the base of some of these big facilities can go 50 feet down. I don't know, maybe even more. But you said the length of some of the blades in your book is 600 feet, 2 football fields. That's how long the blade is?
Well, have you ever seen a picture of a truck hauling one of those?
I have, I guess. I haven't looked close enough. 600 feet. Yeah.
So you see the truck, and then here's a little dolly, the other end of the blade sits on. And he, you know, just to get around a corner, and you can imagine the problem that dolly has got to go this way and then turn and come. Otherwise, they can't get around a corner. There's a picture. It's been about a year since I saw it. Was some guy was crossing a railroad. It was one of those situations where there was a highway and then there was a railroad. So you cross the railroad and then you came, there's the stop sign at the highway. So he crossed the railroad, stopped at the stop sign, but there was too much traffic, he couldn't go, and a train came and hit that thing and just plastered it. But the biggest problem with those blades is they're not recyclable. There's nothing about them that can be reused. So they cut them up into pieces that are 8 or 10 feet long and bury them in the ground. They don't have a future. They're just, the only thing that's really recyclable is in the generator itself. I mean, there's copper and iron and so forth. But the rest of it, you blast out concrete down 4 or 5 feet. The rest of it stays in the ground while they turn it back to cropland. But
another point you mentioned is that sometimes they catch on fire, and if there is a fire 300 feet in the air, the local fire department doesn't have any equipment to fight that, correct?
Well, you could just imagine the cranes that it takes. It's a special crane just to reach up that high to put the thing together. And the fire department could squirt up there, maybe get halfway, but once they catch fire, they're done.
Another item I just wanted to touch on is you cover so much in your book, including details about the Johnstown flood that I had never heard, that you said flood lines from that flood were 89 feet high, and the wave of water that hit Johnstown was 35 to 40 feet high and moving at 40 miles an hour. Then the force of the flood swept several locomotives weighing 170,000 pounds as far as 4,800 feet. So that was just a terrible wall of water caused by a dam breaking. Was that it?
Well, the dam actually held back a lake, was owned by some fairly wealthy men. But unfortunately, they didn't think seriously about maintenance of their property. And the dam sprung a leak. And because it was made out of sedimentary material, you know, rocks and dirt, it washed away rather quickly. So that started down the canyon. And they telegraphed down the way or called down the way to warn the people that it was coming, but they thought it was a joke and nobody did anything about it. And so then it washed a lot of houses and stuff down up next to a concrete bridge. All these houses end up there, and one of them caught fire, and the people that were in the houses burned to death. You'd think they would have found somewhere to get out of there and get up on that thing and get out of there, but they didn't. But, you know, you talk about those locomotives, you look at them locomotives, and you think, how in the world, I mean, how much pressure of water would it take to move a locomotive? These things are really heavy. But that's what happened. And it's interesting, they found bodies months later, way downstream, people that washed out. It was a lot of people died in that flood. And the thing about it, that was the first incident where the Red Cross actually went out and helped people. Northern California, I was going to school in the 60s when we had floods that washed every bridge washed out except some that were there for 100 years. They were still there. But you watch that much water go by. You go back there and look, and there's marks up on a tree, like up there 20 feet high. Here's this wide canyon marked up on the tree. That's how high the water was. How did that much water go down through that country? There was a sawmill right along the Eel River. He picked up all the lumber they had stacked out there to dry, carried it off in the ocean. Cows washed down. They finally went through with a bulldozer and buried cattle all along the ocean. But floods, people say floods are increasing. Floods are just part of nature. I mean, I think the reason I included the story of the Johnstown flood was to show that the flood, but then you have the situation with this guy that built a railroad that went out the Florida Keys. Did you read that chapter? Did you get that far?
I did. Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
But the storm just washed. In fact, I think he finally gave everything he had to the highway department.
Do you know much about this 1862 California flood? That I like to look that up every once in a while. Just a mind-blowing flood that created, it flooded a region 300 miles long and 20 miles wide. One quarter of the state's 800,000 cattle drowned in the flood. It was just a mind-blowing flood. It rained for 43 straight days.
So where was it?
This was in California. It started in December 1861. 66 inches of rain fell in Los Angeles that year. Large brown lakes formed on the normally dry plains between L.A. and the Pacific Ocean, even covering vast areas of the Mojave Desert. In and around Anaheim, flooding of the Santa Ana River created an inland sea 4 feet deep, stretching up to 4 miles from the river and lasting for 4 weeks.
Amazing.
In December, the Sierra Nevada experienced a series of cold Arctic storms that dumped 10 to 15 feet of snow. Anyway, it goes on and on. It lasted a long time. And of course, if that happened today, they would 100% blame carbon dioxide for it, right? If that same thing happens.
Well, it's a fairly common problem. I remember it's been, we were living in Reno, Nevada at the time, but it said, skiers be careful when you ski, but you don't run into a power line because the snow up on the Sierra was like 20 feet, 30 feet deep. And that's a lot of snow.
But everybody thinks that whatever weather happened just now must be the worst ever. But if you learn more about the history, it's probably not, huh?
Well, you read in the paper, last year was the hottest year ever. Well, you get into the details, it was the hottest by maybe a tenth of a degree. You know, we don't have enough weather stations around the world to prove anything. And not only that, if you look at history of temperatures, all right, it's up and down, one hot year, one cold year. Okay, now, if you start your graph over here at the bottom of this, and then you ended at the top of this one over here, what's happening to the temperature?
Right, you can pick a warm.
It's going up.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But if you start your graph at this peak over here, and you ended over here at this valley, what's happening to the temperature?
Yeah, it's cooling.
Well, it's getting colder. So, you know, if I could control the data that's plotted, I could control the narrative, and that's what we're faced with. It's designed to build fear. It's not designed to solve any problems. If they really wanted to solve problems, you know, why does the last president, Obama, buy a house that's almost on the seashore if he thinks the sea's going to rise? Now, is the sea rising? Yes. How much is it rising?
Not much. Less than a foot a century, do you think?
It's about 7 inches a century. It amounts to just a couple of millimeters. And beyond me, I have no idea to know how exactly they can measure that much. Because, you know, the sea, you go out to the pier and watch the seas rise and grows. They must have some way to get at the average.
Yeah, not only is the sea going up and down, but the land is also going up and down, right, in various places.
Well, see, that's another problem. There was, I think it's Boston, because they pumped so much water out of the ground that the land was settling. So that made it look like the sea was rising. And so they blamed it all on climate change. If you start with the basis that man is the cause of all climate change, then you could prove anything. You spend your time looking up all the ways that you can stop man from causing more climate change. So you outlaw all these different things. But how often have you seen an article that goes into the science of what? You know, Al Gore, in his book, An Inconvenient Truth, and the movie by the same name, because temperature and carbon dioxide were going up at the same time, he assumed that carbon dioxide was causing the temperature to rise. And when you go back and look at the ice cores they drilled in Antarctica, that was the conclusion they drew. Well, then men that had a little more time, you see, Antarctica is a desert. So it might only snow a half an inch a year there. And then when it's pressed down, you can see. So to judge from one year to the next, they didn't get those tiny bubbles of gas that are left and evaluate how much. So that's a pretty precise science. But they went back and studied it further. And they realized that the temperature rose first, then the carbon dioxide. So here's my theory, and it's not just a theory, but all of our energy is controlled by the sun. So you look at, there's the sun, and the energy is coming onto the earth. What happens to that energy? well, so much reflected back. And if it's snow on the ground, a lot more of it's reflected back, so it keeps it colder. But the oceans, because the sunshine on the ocean, they start to warm up. But our oceans, some of them are quite deep, a couple of miles, more than that, deep. And water is not a very good transfer of heat. So at the bottom of the ocean are what's called clathrate deposits, clathrates. And a clathrate is natural gas and water that's been frozen. So it's that the gas is actually part of the ice cube itself. So anyway, as the ocean warms, this is just the natural law of science, as it warms, it gives off gas. So as the ocean is gradually warming, it's gradually giving off more carbon dioxide. So that could be a source of a lot of, and carbon dioxide comes from volcanoes, and there are some volcanoes that are under the ocean. So all they do is, did you ever wonder about Northrop, you know, the pipeline, gas pipeline that come from Russia? You know anything about it?
Yeah. Putin talked about it with Tucker Carlson last week, I think. Yeah.
Well, that must have been quite a feat to build that thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But couldn't they use the same principles to repair it? Nobody seems to be too concerned about it.
Yeah, I haven't heard about anything about repair. Good question.
Well, Trump, he was kind of against it anyway. He didn't, because he thought it would help the Russians more than it would help Europe, but that's another story.
Did you hear Putin, when Putin talked it over with Tucker, he said that who destroyed it? Putin said, you did. Tucker said, I was busy that day, but he was indicating Putin thinks that the U.S. did blow it up. But I don't know if we can talk about that on YouTube, but that's what he said.
I don't know. I watched the whole interview.
Another good quote I just wanted to mention from your book is from Rich Lowry, and he says the U.S. is a country with more recoverable oil reserves than Saudi Arabia and Russia, spurning a stupendous source of national wealth to take a flyer on a lunatic experiment, where I think that lunatic experiment is trying to run the U.S. on wind and solar power.
You know how I put that? You have a car. It's a perfectly good car. It's a new car, actually. And you have a tank full of gasoline, and it'll run along at 100 miles an hour if it needed to. But you don't want to pollute the environment, so you get out and push it. And that's where we are with our natural resources. We have more gas and oil than the rest of the world. And it's in Pennsylvania, it's in Texas, it's in other places. And I've even put forth a theory on what I call abiotic oil. It's non-living oil that comes from non-living things. But most of the science indicates it's not so. But I believe that we've got so much oil coming up, it's got to be coming from down deeper as a gas and solidifying into oil or condensing into oil. But most of the scientists say, no, not so. It's all come from dead animals. Can you imagine how many dead animals? You know, my son-in-law worked for the Alyeska, and his job was cleaning oil tanks. They have these huge oil tanks. You go in there and clean them out. They have this 4-foot pipeline that's bringing oil from the North Slope all the way down to Valdez. I have a daughter that lives in Valdez. But there's a tremendous amount of oil there. And so what does our government do? First thing that Biden did when he came into office was he cut off the XL, the pipeline, you know, that was to bring oil from Canada across. He said, that's it, cut that off. And then he stopped all oil development in Alaska. And there's places in Alaska today. You know, they worried sick about the oil pipeline and what effect it was going to have on the animals, and everybody kind of poo-pooed the idea. And so I did a little research on it and found some pictures. But I found that the Alaska oil line did affect the animals. You know how it affected them?
How?
They all congregated around the pipeline because it was warm there.
I read that now that you mentioned it in your book, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we just don't take advantage. We're the wealthiest country in the world, and we're about to lose it because we have leaders that are trying to give it away. We're letting in millions of people from countries we have no control over, and they think it's a secure border, and that's another topic. But we're just not making good use of what we have. And the oil companies, the surprising thing is that some utilities and oil companies are actually pushing some of this wind and solar, which is contrary to their best interest. And I own a little stock. Oil stocks are paying better dividends than most stocks, so they're still staying in business. But we just need to. We need to do something to get control of our leadership, but I don't know. When John Kerry goes to a meeting and makes statements about pledging so many trillions of dollars, and I did a little research, and I'm pretty sure that he couldn't spend a nickel without Congress approving. So usually Congress doesn't want to spend any more money on climate change.
So you mentioned this topic of abiotic hydrocarbons. So just as you were talking, I looked this up in 2006. Here's an article on NASA.gov saying, scientists solve the mystery of methane in Titan's atmosphere. So international team is looking at hydrocarbons on Saturn's moon, Titan. And why are there hydrocarbons on Titan? I've never heard anybody explain that if hydrocarbons have to come from life, why are they on Titan? Do you have any comment on that?
You know, methane, CH4, could be produced in all kinds of circumstances. I mean, every time you flagellate, you let out a little CH4. I remember growing up, there was a handle in the bathroom. I never knew why it was. Well, I had one brother that was a little more active than others, that he'd light that candle. And you can get enough in a room that it'll burn. Hmm. But methane, you know, what was the moon? It was one of Saturn's moons. Now they decided the center is water. They weren't sick about it. If they could find water on one of these other planets, then of course we can move some of our excess people out of our country. But you remember, it's been 20, 30 years ago, they predicted that the world couldn't sustain any more people, and all these people would die. And since then, the world population has just about doubled, because we can grow more food. You know, we could feed most of the world with the food we raise.
I want to change topics a little bit again and read a couple of quotes from your book on Greenland, on temperature fluctuations in Greenland. First one is, the record indicates warmer temperatures were the norm in Greenland in the earlier part of the past 4,000 years, including century-long intervals nearly 1 degree centigrade warmer than the recent decade, the first decade of this century. And then the next thing you said is, a P-38 airplane from World War II landed on the ice during the war and was covered by almost 300 feet of snow when it was found in recent times. They were able to get it flying again, I think. But if the Greenland ice cap is melting so much, why were those planes buried so deeply?
Greenland's an interesting case. I mean, for one thing, when you study the issue, you think of Greenland as just a kind of a flat island with all this ice on top of it. Greenland actually is mountains and valleys, so if all the ice that could melt, it still wouldn't affect the ocean very much. Greenland is called Greenland because at one time it was a green land. It's not a green land today, but they raised, you find old stone churches and so forth where people live. But right now, Greenland is fairly cold. And this airplane, what happened was their navigator got mixed up. Instead of going one direction, they came the other, and they ended up over the top of Greenland. There was that P-38 and a cargo plane. They landed. Some guys with a dog train come and rescued them. So this plane sat there, and they knew where it was. They knew exactly where it was. And they went out there once looking for it, didn't find it. But then they got I think it's called a ground penetrating radar. It's a, you know, something, and they just kept working until they found it. It had moved down slope about a mile. So then they bored a hole about 4 foot in diameter, and they had a barrel. They kept heating this water to melt the snow, and they kept bailing it out till they got down there. And they took that plane apart. Don't ask me how, but they took it apart, and they brought it up out of there in pieces, and they put it back together and flew it. It's quite an interesting story. I think I covered that in my book. But Antarctica, which we think about, you know, Antarctica's going to melt, and the world's going to be flooded, and the sea's going to rise, and all these coastal towns will be drowned. That's just a lot of hooey, because Antarctica's a desert, and outside of one peninsula that runs up toward Argentina, where the snow does melt once in a while, but there's all these little birds that live there, and they hop around, and they get in the ocean, and they eat fish and so forth. And did you ever wonder why there aren't any polar bears on the South Pole?
Too cold for them, right?
They can't live there. It's too cold. Polar bears, by the way, you can see the polar bear on my cover. And there's another outfit that wanted to republish my book, so they come up with a new cover. And their book is $2 more than this one, so I don't know if they're selling it or not. I thought they were a fraud because they said that if I'd work with them, they'd give me $70,000 royalty and 5 copies of the book. Hmm. And this went on for week after week, and I said, I'm not going to talk to you anymore until you either get me the $70,000 or the books. So they finally, they sent me a copy of the book. And but the $70,000 never turned up. You know, there's so many frauds out there today. And I get a call probably once a week. Someone, they're having a book fair, and they want to show my book. And they're doing me a favor, you know, by showing my book. And I'm usually fairly busy, so I'll stop them. I'll say, what's this going to cost? Usually I have to ask them about 3 times. Friday, they'll say, well, it's only going to be $5,000. And I'll say, do you know how many copies of my book you'd have to sell to make $5,000?
Interesting. But actually, I have another thing from your book about the Greenland ice cap. It says the Greenland ice cap was about the same size as today during the 2.5 degrees centigrade warmer Holocene climate optimum. And that I did not know. So it was way warmer, but yet the ice cap was the same size about?
Well, let's face it, how much, let's say ice melts at 32, okay? Will it melt at 33?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Will it melt at 31?
Nope.
Will it melt at 30?
Nope.
Will it melt at 10?
Nope.
So if the temperature warms from 10 degrees to 11, is it going to melt a lot more ice?
No.
No. See, that's the point. Greenland may be warming, but it's not warming past the freeze point, except, you know, there are some villages around the coast of Greenland where people live. We had a friend that lived there for a couple of years. I don't know what their industry is. Probably fish. I don't know what else they could do for a living because it's too cold to grow any kind of crops. But there was a time when they did. There was about 1,000 years when Greenland was an effective source of food.
So I'm trying to understand this. Do you think 2.5C warming starting at the depth of the last ice age, did that cause way more sea level rise than that same 2.5C of warming from here? Because there was so much ice that was like way down into the U.S., et cetera. And when that melted, that eventually caused the 400 feet of sea level rise. Because go ahead.
I'm not a paleontologist, but I'm told that right here in Idaho at one time, there was 2 miles thick ice. And we live in a valley, which is an aquifer, but there's all these rocks, and some of them are, I don't know, foot and a half, and they're all granite. And the closest granite is in northern Canada. So those rocks have been carried by glaciers from northern Canada all the way to here. So the sea was down about 600 feet, and it rose up to where it is as the glaciers melted. Now, there's a few mountain glaciers in Antarctica and Greenland that could still be melting, but the matter of melting is only affecting the sea a few millimeter a year. And they would have to be terrified. You know, did you ever see the movie Day After Tomorrow?
I did see that, yes. Yep.
I mean, where the water just floods down the street there in New York and the library and all this stuff. I mean, it's excellent movie, but it doesn't have anything to do with science. I mean, the amount of the sea rises. If you lived right next to it and you put a stake in the ground, this is how far the wave made it today, and you went out a year later and put a stake in the ground, you probably wouldn't notice much difference, because a couple of millimeters is not much.
One other unrelated topic I wanted to mention here is you have just a little topic on acid rain, or a little chapter on that. And you tell us that pure water has a pH of 7. I did not know this, though. Natural unpolluted rainwater actually has a pH of about 5.6, acidic. And the oceans are more like 8.1 or 8.2, so they are alkaline. And they're not acidic in any way. And this whole idea of shells being dissolved, mollusks are losing their shells because of acid, the acidity of the ocean, that's just not true, is it?
You know, you could take a mollusk out of the ocean and put it in a fish tank, you know, like a goldfish tank, and pour in a certain amount of acid, you could make its shell melt. But remember, look at the Rockies. Almost all those mountains are limestone. Where did the limestone come from? From dying shellfish, stacked up for thousands of years or hundreds of years, depending on your frame of reference. But I remember this one guy, he holds up this mollusk that had a soft shell, and he was trying to prove something. At that pH level, they survive very well. Coral is another one. It's a big, you know, a big issue about, oh, the corals are disappearing. And, well, they do. They change, and they have a symbiotic relationship with algae. It's so different colored algae changes the color of the coral. But as the sea rises, the coral grows. Coral's actually an animal. I always thought of it as kind of as a plant because it's kind of stuck down, but it's an animal. But when the ocean rises 600 feet and then things stabilize, you know, I don't think any of us are ever going to have. I mean, the ocean rises so slowly that you could build seawalls to protect any town. There's places, I don't know if you've ever read Al Gore's book, An Inconvenient Truth, or watched his movie.
Both, yeah.
But there was an Englishman by the name of Dimmock. He had a kid in school, and he had to watch the film. And so he sued Al Gore, and the judge concluded that there were 9 errors in the book and in the movie. And actually, there were like 23, but he only dealt with 9 of them. But he said, in regards to this island out there, Tuvalu, that's, you know, the whole island's like only 3 feet above sea level. And he said, Al Gore said they were all endangered and they were fleeing the sea and so forth. And he said, the judge said, there's no evidence that anybody has left this island for anywhere else. I mean, that's just the kind of, it's designed to build fear. It's not designed to solve a problem because there is no problem. If you don't have a problem, how do you just solve a problem that's not a problem?
So thanks for bringing this up, because your chapter 4 is about Al Gore, and it's actually 35 errors there. And you detail all 35 errors that were in Al Gore's film. And you mentioned Stuart Dimmock, and you mentioned the judge name was Michael Burton, who ruled on the film that they could show it in schools, but they had to tell the kids about 9 of the errors, I believe. And another thing you wrote that I really liked is that if they show that film in schools, they should show the Great Global Warming Swindle along with it. I would love it if they would show both of those films.
Have you seen it?
I have seen it. I've seen it multiple times. And actually, I'm working with Martin Durkin right now to do the sequel to it, and the sequel's coming out next month.
Well, I'd love to see that. You know, yeah. One of the guys that said that was Tim Ball. You know anything about Tim Ball?
I do, yeah. He sadly passed away recently, didn't he, in the last year or
right.
so?
But Michael Mann, he drove him to his grave. He sued him, and Michael Mann just won $1 million. I hope Mark Stein, right?
Mark Stein, yes.
I hope he appeals this. This is crazy. That man should never have any audience. Michael Mann is, well, I got this thing hanging on my wall. I got it at a climate conference. It's just a hockey stick, but it deals with, he posited that the climate just going to rise just till it burns us up. Well, you know, the temperature goes up, it comes down. It's, it's too bad because the American people deserve something better.
I think Mark Stein has already written that an appeal is coming. It's not over yet.
Washington, D.C. is 95% Democrat. Nobody could get a fair trial in Washington, D.C.
Do you have other stuff you'd like to bring up, or should we go ahead and wrap up here?
No, I think you're doing great. I'd be glad to be on the program again sometime if you're still alive.
I hope I am. I'll let you know. So thank you very much, Jim Hollingsworth, and everybody should read your book. I'll put a link to it, the Amazon link.
It's a book anybody can understand.
We'll talk to you later. Thank you.
Thank
Goodbye.
You.